From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, a prison advocacy group explains their demands for the governor after several outbreaks of COVID-19 in Wisconsin prisons. Then we learn about Project Return, and a formerly incarcerated man talks about his experience rejoining his community.
I was no longer referred to as Rodney. I was all kinds of other names, you know, offender. Eventually, what it did is I started to believe that stuff about myself.
Contributor Kyle Cherick joins us to talk about how farms and CSAs have adjusted and used the pandemic to reach new audiences.
It's way more than just tomatoes and broccoli. And whenever you buy local, more than 60 cents of your dollar stays in your community. And how can that not be a good thing?
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Family members and loved ones of people incarcerated in Wisconsin are growing more concerned about the spread of COVID-19. At least three state prisons have reported outbreaks among inmates, and at least two people have died at the Dodge County Correctional Facility. The number of deaths inside prisons from COVID-19 could be higher, but the Department of Corrections doesn't release that information due to privacy concerns. Prisoner advocacy groups continue to call on Governor Tony Evers to take action and protect people who are incarcerated. Peggy Westrader is an organizer with EXPO, Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing. She spoke to WUWM's Latoya Dennis about what's going on in Wisconsin's prisons and what changes they want to see made.
Well, the first thing I think is that it was 100% preventable. You know, we've been asking the governor to decarcerate our prison system. You know, we've using COVID as a special circumstance since about March 20th. And so the governor knew that this was, you know, that this was a possibility. This is now the second round of COVID and positive COVID in the Wisconsin prison system. It's worse this time than it was the first time. So, you know, it's COVID is up north now in Wisconsin, and you have correctional officers who obviously live in those communities. They're coming in and out of those facilities. And clearly there was not enough done to protect the people in their care. And, you know, one of the arguments that we've been making is that for you and I, we have the three W's, right? Which is that we're standing 6 feet away from each other, that we're wearing masks, and that we're washing our hands and we're using hand sanitizer. Well, two of those options aren't available to people that are in the Wisconsin prison system, and that is social distancing, which is next to impossible. And then the hand washing is available, but using hand sanitizer is not. And then in regards to masks, they've been issued masks. But again, you know, they just came around also with the second round of, you know, you really need to start wearing masks as family members. We were just allowed last, was it September 25th, was the first day that we were allowed to buy our loved ones masks and send masks in. Before that, they received two masks a week with their commissary. And again, as you know, you're supposed to wear your mask once and then you wash it. Or if you're wearing disposable masks, then you throw them away. So they, you know, they really haven't done enough. At Dodge Correctional, that there have been, you know, as many as 235 cases. You know, there are nursing home units at that prison. There are people that have pre-existing conditions. And as we found out, that two people have died from COVID-19 at Dodge, and both of them were in their 60s. And so, again, had the governor acted when we asked him to, it's very likely that those two people would still be alive because they fit into the criteria of people that we asked for him to be releasing. No one in the state of Wisconsin has received a death sentence. And that's what this is becoming.
Now, when you call on the governor to deincarcerate the prisons to let people out, who are you talking about? Who would you like to see released?
What we would like is for the governor to set up a process where he is reviewing people that have been declined for compassionate release in the past. We want him to go back in and re-review those applications and say, if you knew that there was a virus, because there is, that would kill you if it attacked a person with a pre-existing condition, with an autoimmune deficiency, someone who was elderly, you know, would you then look at this application differently? And would you then grant this person release? So people definitely that are eligible for compassionate release are one of the groups that we would like for him to review. The other group is people that are currently serving a sentence for revocation. Every year, the state of Wisconsin, we're third highest in the nation for revoking people from their parole. And most of those revocations happen due to crimeless rule violations. What we're asking the DOC to do is go back in and look and see 30% of the people that you incarcerated this year were due to a crimeless rule violation. Is there some type of community programming that they could do? Is there some type of community support that you could offer them so that they could be out of prison and not contributing to the overcrowding, and instead being, you know, at home with their families and receiving whatever assistance they need in the community? And then the last group is a group that we've continuously been talking about, which is the old law parolees. So when Wisconsin switched to truth in sentencing, the last phase was in the year 2000, they trapped about 3,000 people in the Wisconsin prison system. 2,500 of those people are still trapped in the system. And so what we want for the governor to do is to give the parole chair, John Tate, additional resources, and we want them to work through those cases and get some of those people home. Many of those people have already served at least 13 years past what their sentencing judge thought that they would serve. And so we believe that with additional resources, we could bring many of those people home. All of that helps to, again, alleviate the overcrowding in our prisons and create a situation where possibly you could have one person per cell, you could have one person per bunk, and therefore, you know, lowering the chance of spreading COVID in the prison system. We're not asking that you just open the prison gates and say, everybody gets to go home. We understand, you know, prison does serve a purpose, but we have also in Wisconsin fallen in love with incarcerating people. And there are other forms of punishment besides for incarceration. And if you're talking about redemption or rehabilitation, you know, prison, it may not be, you know, the answer at all. We just feel like there's too many people in the Wisconsin prison system. And again, we're very overcrowded. And at this particular moment in time, that is becoming detrimental and it's actually killing people.
Would it take an act of the legislature, or is this something that the governor could do himself?
This is absolutely something that the governor could do himself. There was actually a report released in April or May from the Legislative Reference Bureau outlining everything that the governor could do in order to decarcerate the prisons. It actually encouraged the decarceration of our prisons due to COVID. COVID provides a special circumstance, which is, you know, something that, again, opens up a lot of opportunities for different avenues for people to be released. But the governor, he's not receptive to any form of relief for the people in the correctional system. And if you listen, you know, he does weekly news conferences and things like that. He's never released a statement regarding his feelings about people who are incarcerated in their circumstance. He never talks about people who are incarcerated in his press conferences. They never cover the number of people that have been infected with COVID in the prison system in his press conferences. And when he did the statewide mask mandate, he excluded incarcerated people from that mandate. So I guess if you were to, you know, accumulate all of that information, you may just come to the conclusion that the governor just literally does not care about people who are incarcerated.
Now, some people listening to this might say, all right, opening the prisons and letting people out is an extreme measure. Is there more the state could be doing that's not letting people out, that's not releasing people?
Well, I mean, considering that in the state of Wisconsin, anyone who is released, so let's say that you had a 10-year sentence and you're within the window of what Expo and Wisdom are asking for, which is within one year of your release date. So what would happen is you are released, you are put on community supervision, you then get that additional time added to your supervision. So you're not at all getting, you know, you're out of prison, yes, but you're not at all, you know, off the hook, and you still owe the state of Wisconsin that time. You were given that time and you're still going to serve that time. You're just going to serve it again in a different venue. States like Minnesota, they tend to hand out more supervision than they do prison times because it's kinder to the taxpayers in the state. So are there other things that they could do? I mean, definitely they need to make sure that, you know, the correctional officers are wearing masks. They need to make sure that they're calling in when they're sick, that they're not coming in when they're symptoms. When they have symptoms, they need to increase testing among their correctional officers and make sure the people that are not asymptomatic are, they're not coming to work. You have to understand that most of the state correctional facilities are antiquated buildings that don't have windows that you're allowed to open. The ventilation systems are outdated. And so you're basically introducing a virus into a situation where it only can grow. It's up to you to make sure that your cellie is wearing their mask, that you're wearing your mask, that you're washing your hands. And again, they're not able to have access to hand sanitizer because it has alcohol in it. And cleaning products are locked in a closet. You have to have permission to be able to go and get them. And unless you're taking serious measures to sanitize and to, make sure that people are wearing masks and to quarantine people, which has become a huge issue and is a huge issue at Cattle Marine Correctional Institute because they don't have space. They're so full. Our prison system is 33% overpopulated, and so they don't have room to quarantine people. So you could very well be sharing a cell with someone who is positive and you're not positive, and you're basically, you know, a sitting duck.
Peggy West Schrader is the lead legislative organizer with Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing. She spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis. Coming up, we'll learn about Project Return, which helps formerly incarcerated people rejoin their communities. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The problems facing incarcerated people often don't end when they're released. People who've served time in prison can face discrimination when looking for housing or a job, and the stigma of going to prison can make it difficult to reestablish ties in their community. That's why Pastor Jill Elwanger decided to found Project Return. 40 years ago, his congregation was looking for ways to better their neighborhood and found that formerly incarcerated people returning to their community, like Rodney Evans, needed help dealing with prejudice and regaining a sense of worth. Evans is now the corporate board president of Project Return. He and Pastor Elwanger joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the program.
To start here, just tell me a bit about Project Return. How do you describe the work that you do?
Well, the way that it affected my life and the way that I see it is it started out 40 years ago. A group of people in a church in a community were seeing a problem in that community, and they made up their minds that they wanted to do something about that problem. Well, 40 years later, we're an organization that helps people coming back into the community from incarceration in every aspect of their lives. We want to be a resource of some kind for them to acclimate themselves back into the community in a safe and a productive way.
The special focus in helping people come back and make a successful return to the community is to help them find a job, and then secondly, housing, and then thirdly, some support, giving them the certainty that there are people around them that are going to be there if they need some assistance.
Now, when we think about people who were formerly incarcerated, former prisoners, what are some of the general misconceptions that people have about people who have been in prison and now are re-entering their community?
Well, there are many misconceptions.
Yeah.
And probably the most serious one is that people think that because somebody committed a crime, and it may not even have been a very serious crime, like possession of marijuana, whatever the crime may have been, people think that that person is the same 10 years later or 20 years later as they were when they went into the system. And that's just not true. We're all changing constantly, and that's true for people who are incarcerated. So we need to understand that people do change and that they are humans just like us.
Rodney, for you, when you re-entered your community, what were some of the things that you faced from people, some of the ideas that people had about you?
I mean, like Pastor Joe said, I was the same person, if not worse, that I needed to pay for whatever it was that I was doing time for the rest of my life. And just, I was no longer referred to as Rodney. I was all kinds of other names, you know, offender. You know, I had to go see a PO, and, you know, I was a number. So no identity. And eventually what it did is I started to believe that stuff about myself. So Project Return has been instrumental in helping me to see that I am not those things that was projected onto me from being incarcerated.
Yeah, as someone who was a client of Project Return, why was this an organization that you decided to become involved with after your incarceration?
Well, actually, I was referred to Project Return by my PO instead of being sent back to prison. So I got arrested. I look at it like I was violently snatched out of my comfort zone, which was drugs and alcohol, that lifestyle. And I was put in this program. And the only thing that kept me from continuing to live that life in the beginning was I didn't want to go back to prison. But then it became a thing of they treated me like I was no different than one of them. So even in my mind, when I thought that I was less than, they treated me like I was one of them. And eventually, the love that they continued to show me took away my options to go back to where I was. And then it started to build me up to see a whole different side of life. So I didn't choose in the beginning to be there. But once I was there for 12 weeks, because that's how long my program was, I knew for a fact that this place was a saving place for me.
Well, now you've worked up to becoming the president of the board, so it must be an organization that you believe in.
Oh, my God. First of all, you have to understand that all of that stuff was by the grace of God. You know, I just was there. All I knew was that I needed this place. This place pumped life into me. And so I just stayed there to receive that life, and I just happened to be in places at times where I had the opportunity to be on the board, And then one time I was on the board and I had the opportunity to become the president. And this was nothing that I was aspiring to do, but it happened. And it was just part of this new life that I was living. And I am very, 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 very grateful for this experience.
You talked a bit about what your transition was like, at least, you know, how people responded to your getting out of prison, you serving your time. What are some of the common challenges that formerly incarcerated people face when they reenter the community? And this is both a question for you, Rodney, and you, Pastor Joe.
One of the main places that I realized it was a whole lot of pushback was just finding a job. I'm an excellent worker. I have my own business right now. But when I was in Project Return and I was going to these temporary services and putting my heart into these jobs, man, they would turn around in a minute and be like, oh, we can't accept you. And it was simply because of my criminal history.
Yeah, I think one of the big things that has to be overcome when people come out is precisely that history. When they try to apply for a job, the employer or the human resources person checks on the internet to see what background is reported there. And then once they find that they are a formerly incarcerated person, then their application is usually off the table. That in itself is a real barrier to getting a job. But then secondly, when you get turned down again and again and again, you begin to lose hope that you ever will get a job. And so that becomes a very personal challenge to keep trying and to keep hope alive, as Jesse Jackson puts it.
Right.
Pastor Joe, this is an organization that you've been involved with for a long time. What drew you to this mission?
Well, I could go all the way back to my parish in Birmingham, Alabama. I was a pastor in an African-American congregation in Birmingham from 1958 to 1967. And, of course, that was right at the time of the Civil Rights Movement, and I was in the right place at the right time to be a part of the Birmingham demonstrations in 1963 and the demonstrations in Selma in 1965, led by Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Well, that's where I learned very clearly that as a person of faith, I should be involved in the larger community and should be involved in bringing about justice and removing some of the injustices. So that's where the whole motivation came from. But then when I got to Milwaukee and our congregation did a study of the surrounding community and how we could reach out and be of service and significance to the community, we discovered that there were four pre-release centers, four minimum security prisons, within a mile or two of our congregation, and we found out that the services there for the men and women were very few, but we found out that community people could actually volunteer and work with them, and that's when we started Project Return to really help people coming back make that positive return, because we found out how many people go back into the system because they can't navigate that reentry period that comes as a big shocker when they come out of the system and meet with various barriers. So we got drawn in because our congregation said we need to be doing something and walking with these people who are coming back.
As you just mentioned, of course, you marched during the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s, and we're right now, for this time, we're having a racial justice movement. And this is a question for both you and Rodney. Where does mass incarceration fit into this larger picture of racial justice in the United States today?
for a nation such as ours, with all the resources that we have, to have the highest rate of incarceration of any country in the world, including China and Russia and countries that, you know, we sort of imagine as being extremely oppressive, we have the highest rate of incarceration. So there's something wrong with our system. There are a lot of things wrong, but the mass incarceration has resulted for many reasons, and one of the big reasons is because we do not have the proper resources and services available for people when they come out. And the result is that half of the people going into prison in Wisconsin every year are people who have not committed any new crime, but simply have broken a rule of their community supervision that they're under when they come out. The failure of people to make it in reentry is what feeds mass incarceration in Wisconsin and in this country.
And then the second thing is quite profitable.
Can you unpack that a bit?
It's big business. There's a lot of money being made off of warehousing people. It's a lot of money being made in different ways.
Yeah, to unpack that a bit for listeners who might be less familiar with mass incarceration, when we talk about the money that is created through warehousing people, it's not simply by imprisoning people, but rather the people who are paid to work at these prisons, the different companies that are paid to supply different things to the prisons, whether that's food or bedding or clothing.
Or razors, yeah.
Or razors. The variety of companies that ultimately profit from the government paying for people to be in prison.
That is correct. You have just fleshed out what Rodney has said. Correct.
Right.
Now, when it comes to a program like Project Return, what is it that you want people to understand about this kind of programming, which they might not quite get?
Well, one of the things that I would like to say that Project Return wants the community to understand about Project Return is that, number one, we have a great love for our community, for a healthy community.
All right. Well, Rodney, Pastor Joe, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Joy.
Pastor Jill Elwanger is the founder of Project Return. Rodney Evans is the corporate board president and a former client of the project. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Later this month, Project Return is holding its 40th annual gala. The virtual event will be held October 27th, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. Coming up next, contributor Kyle Cherick joins us to talk about CSAs and how they've adjusted during the pandemic. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It is now fall, which of course goes hand in hand with the word harvest. And while grocery stores have adjusted to the higher demands and farmers markets are wrapping up their season, 2020 has made a lot of people think more about how and who they get their food from. In March, searches for CSAs, or community-supported agriculture, jumped during the initial stages of the coronavirus pandemic when grocery store shelves were picked clean. But where grocery stores may have left a gap, local farms and CSA groups have swept in to take advantage of an opportunity to reach new audiences. Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherick joins me now to talk about these changes and begins by sharing some of the best produce the season has to offer.
You know, the summer gets all the attention, and I used to say pre-pandemic that summer was the easiest time to be a chef because all you had to do was heat it up, give it a little bit of salt, and get out of the way of the ingredients, and it was hard to turn in a bad meal. Fall, is equally as good, but it doesn't get as much attention. But there's the three peas, there's the peppers and the pears and the parsnips, and then broccoli and carrots and spinach and winter spinach and cauliflower and apples, which everybody rallies around apples this time of year. Potatoes are very much a fall crop, squash, of course, and the list kind of goes on and on and on and on. And there's so many things that we think of in the summer that actually have fall and winter versions or derivations, or that can be grown to a certain extent in the hoop house. And it's Chef Dan Barber that really brought it to the fore some years ago, where the root vegetables that can survive or do survive through the cold freezes, every time a freeze comes through at the top of the ground, the sugars in the root vegetable crank up, and as a form of energy and then preservation that the root vegetable can essentially live off of. And so when we harvest those carrots, in this example, in late November, for any of the listeners that haven't had them, it's a carrot unlike anything you've ever eaten, because it's got this incredibly sweet. Take, if anybody's ever had carrot juice and then added honey to it, it's that kind of thing, only with all of the crunch. It's absolutely fantastic.
I know initially in this pandemic, there was a lot of concern on how grocery stores could keep up, especially as people reverted to base human nature to stock up on things. You know, grocery stores have never been more busy as we all choose to prepare more things at home versus going out. And I think grocery stores, for the most part, have adjusted to being able to sustain their shelves. But what kind of gap has this created?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting time in the food system just to stand back and take a moment away from being someone participating in the pandemic, but just watch what was happening in our food system, because the supply chain that we've created for our food system is based on this incredible velocity. And that's relative to restaurants or grab and go or grocery stores or what have you. And, you know, two things happened with the pandemic. One, people were really hoarding things, and much of them were the canned goods, were the non-perishables. And so the fresh things didn't get bought up with as much efficiency, because for the first couple of months, people just weren't going to the grocery store and they weren't hitting the quote unquote green section, right? The fresh section as much. And restaurants at the same time were ordering far, far, far less. So I don't know how many chefs, just because I didn't keep a tally, but let's see, it was 30 or 40 that I spoke to in the first 30 or 40 days of the pandemic really taking hold. So mid-March to mid-April, where they said, you know, they would get boxes of produce, but 20% of it or 30% of it would be bad, just because the suppliers, and they're not to be faulted, were so used to a quicker velocity of sending fresh goods out that things had slowed down so much. So the grocery stores and the supply chains have really pivoted, but consumers have really pivoted into a couple of different sectors too. One of which is CSAs, Community Sustainable Agriculture, have really become incredibly robust. So they, you know, they came on as an aspect of the whole farm to table and seasonal regional kind of thing that my career on television really was part of that boom, that 10 to 12 year cycle where people started orientating more towards local things. But CSAs, where you would basically pay shares into the CSA, and then on a weekly basis, or in some cases a biweekly basis, you go to that essentially meeting site, you're socially distanced, and you get your big bag or box or whatever of all of the things that the farm grows. And so you're getting local, your carbon footprint is less, you know, your dollar cost averaging. Things are incredibly fresh. If you pick up at your CSA on Saturday, the stuff was probably pulled out of the ground either that morning or Friday. And there's just no grocer in the world that can even, you know, come close to touching that.
Yeah, and with the CSAs, while you mentioned, of course, it's been around for quite some time, how have different organizations not only adjusted to the pandemic, but taken the opportunity to reach new consumers that perhaps would have never even considered a CSA before they were considering, how many times am I going out to a grocery store?
Right, right. Well, there, certainly the web searches, and I don't have the exact numbers, but I did some research on this, and the web searches for local food, CSAs, you know, that sort of thing, particularly CSAs, really tipped up in March. And the CSAs, at least the smart ones, pivoted beautifully. And instead of just having produce from their farm, they started connecting to other outlets. So they started carrying bread from local bakery. They started getting butchered products and meat products from other purveyors that were local as well. They started getting dairy from other people, creameries and so on and so forth, honey et cetera, nearly everything in each had their own structure, but nearly everything except for the sort of, you know, breakfast cereals and paper towels that you would get at a grocery store. RCSA Lofbottle has everything from cheese to, we get all of our meats there. We get, of course, all the produce. We get breads. We get tortillas. We get, I mean, you know, except for, like I said, the paper goods and some cleaning products, between Lofbottle and Imperfect Foods, which is another organization we'll talk about, we don't need to go to the grocery store. And I want grocery stores to survive. Don't get me wrong. I'm a big fan of the right, mindful, you know, thoughtful grocers. But in regards to food trends and the pandemic, CSAs and many of them really stepped up to have this broad range of food, and then moved into essentially animal shares, where you can purchase half of a hog or a whole hog.
So one thing you mentioned is Imperfect Foods, and this I have seen grow in their, you know, social media, national presence. So does ugly produce that they send to you, you know, has it made a considerable amount of waste that hasn't really been utilized until recently by this company?
Yeah, I mean, the waste that's in the food system is just staggering. It's 30 to 40% aggregately, 31% at retail. The most recent, you know, really dig deep numbers that I like to share with listeners, because I don't want to just throw out statistics, but going back to 2010, so 10 years ago, $161 billion a year is lost in food waste in our food industry. And Imperfect Foods is doing a really terrific thing to basically assuage that. We get a box once a week. I think the top price for the box is somewhere in the $70. We choose the things that we want. So it comes in at about $40. It's got fruits, vegetables, dairy, oat milk. You know, it's kind of a grab bag and different every week, but you have the option to select what you don't want or add in what you do want. So it isn't like they're just foisting it upon you. And my wife and I stand back and look at this big, I mean, this really huge box full of Bounty. And one, we say, at the grocery store, this would cost us a heck of a lot more than $40, $45. And two, we kind of challenge each other and say, find the imperfection. Like, I can't figure out what is wrong with this apple or these peaches or this butter or this oat milk. Or, I mean, I just don't know where the imperfection is. But within the grocery system, everything's so formulated that the apples have to be just the right size, the peaches, et cetera. I mean, there was one apple that was photographed perfect, but it had two leaves still on it. And I thought, oh, that must've been it. Like, it still had the leaves on it. So that was, it wasn't uniform enough. So Imperfect Foods has really done a great job. And again, it solves for the troubled times that we're in that this box comes to your door, and all of your fruits, your vegetables, your that sort of thing are provided for without having to go into an environment where there's a less social distancing and some people might feel challenged.
Right. And I know maybe a lot of people are just starting to explore some other options of how they can get produce. And one way that you recommend they search for their local availability is something that's a tool that's called Farm Fresh Atlas.
Yeah. I mean, Farm Fresh Atlas is just a blessing on the land. It's this incredible aggregator. The one that we have for the southeastern Wisconsin comes out of the UW Extension in Kenosha. The one for the middle of the state is run out by the REAP food group in Madison. And you can go to their website and you can click on an area and it shows this abundance of farms and do they have CSAs or do you drive up or how do you get subscription to their vegetables and what do they sell? And, you know, do they do, I mean, there's everything from buffalo meat to we've gotten a turkey from Farm Fresh Atlas Farms for as long as I can remember. And that season's coming up. And it really acquaints you with all of the abundance that's grown right here. And one of the troubles with our food system is that there's this gap in between. So you've got pretty really micro small farms that grow their things and then they can sell them and get by at supplying some restaurants and farmers markets and things like that. And of course they're challenged now. And then there's the much larger, more quote unquote conventional or industrial farms that work with the supply chain that then, you know, grow lots of crops and or proteins and then send them off through the system. But there's this huge space in between of all these mid-sized farms that just don't quite qualify for either category. And so finding an outlet for them, which is one of the things that the Fresh Farm Atlas does, is really a wonderful thing because one, they're family owned and they're growing great stuff, but it's an avenue to get that produce, those proteins to people nearby who want it. And again, it's great. It minimizes the carbon footprint. That may not be a thing for most people, but well, whether it is or isn't, it's cool. It's a good thing. Anyway.
All right. And then one other thing, you know, this is making us think about what is local. And, you know, largely I'd say if something is sourced from Wisconsin, that's a good thing to consider local because, you know, things that surround Milwaukee, you need to be tapped into. But one thing that kind of combines all these things into one place and resource is Milwaukee Farmers United.
Yeah, I mean, great organization. And again, they're a bunch of local farms that came together and said, we're stronger together. And again, subscribing to their website, you can pick the things that you want. And they've got everything from coffee to bread to rice to, you know, pasta to salsas. It's way more than just tomatoes and broccoli. And whenever you buy local, more than 60 cents of your dollar stays in your community. And how can that not be a good thing?
Very true. And do you think that the whole concept of we're stronger together, the farmers uniting in let's combine our produce, let's get this to people in one package, is this something that's been in development for quite some time, or did the pandemic really amplify the need to combine services?
Yeah, I think there were small and very distinctive skitterings happening. And I think Fresh Farm Atlas, who's been around for a long time, is a good template. But this pandemic, as it has for so many things across so many aspects of humanity, have really coalesced certain movements. And I think this sort of thing is here to stay, and it will only grow stronger. There's no way the grocery stores are going to drop away curbside pickup once we have a vaccine and everybody's back to being out. It's just a convenience that we have. And it's the same in the farming community with getting local goods into everybody's, you know, refrigerators and on their cooking kitchen counters. That's how it's going to be. And I think that's, if there's any silver lining, that's one of them.
Well, thank you very much, Kyle.
Thanks, Audrey. Always love talking to you. And next month we'll talk turkeys and Thanksgiving and get our heads out of this COVID stuff for a while.
I look forward to it. Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is a culinary historian and essayist. You can explore his past segments at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then learn about the COVID-19 journaling project. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We are undoubtedly in a historic time. The pandemic is a huge moment in our collective history happening to all of us, and it's important that people in the future can learn about our experiences. There's perhaps no better way to do that than through firsthand accounts. In 1861, the Wisconsin Historical Society's founder, Lyman Draper, asked soldiers stationed at Camp Randall in Madison to help document the Civil War by keeping a diary. Today, these documents are incredibly valuable as a way to experience history. The Historical Society is asking the same of us through its COVID-19 journaling project. The project is seeking people of all ages to keep journals in any format. To learn more about it, I spoke with Simone Munson, the Wisconsin Historical Society Librarian Archives Collection Development Coordinator.
Simone Munson, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here.
So what was the first crisis the Wisconsin Historical Society worked to document in real time with everyday Wisconsinites?
You know, the Wisconsin Historical Society was founded back in 1846, and some of our founding members definitely had this idea of documenting history in real time. Probably one of our most well-known founders, his name was Lyman Draper, and he had a real interest in the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, and he did research in that. So when the Civil War started brewing and things related to the Civil War started happening, he definitely saw that as an opportunity to be capturing history as it happened. And so he really encouraged soldiers that served for Wisconsin Infantry to keep journals and diaries to document their experiences in the Civil War. And really, that was the first opportunity that the Historical Society had to do this collecting in real time.
So we may think that history needs to be in books we read in school or already be a time well before our modern lives with modern technology, but what's happening right now is historical.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we often sort of take for granted that the things that we're experiencing today will one day be in history books. So the pandemic and things related to, you know, world health are definitely something that will be talked about in the future.
So what are you asking people to do now to add our voices to this historical event?
Yeah, so the Historical Society has come up with something we're calling the COVID-19 Journaling Project. And really what we're doing is we're encouraging people to keep journals in any format that they want to. It could be a traditional, you know, pen and paper kind of journal. It could be a photo journal. It could be an audio recording that they do every day, just to sort of get down the events of what is happening in the world, how people are coping with this situation that we're living in, and kind of help us create a really strong timeline for how the pandemic happens, how it's unfolding, how people are dealing with it, and then how people kind of come out on the other side and what we're seeing after this event is over.
So given that a lot of things are developing, is there a timeline for how long you want people to journal?
So the way that the project is set up is that we're hoping that people can keep a journal for 30, 60, or 90 days and go from there. Obviously, if things last longer and we need to keep journals for longer, we can do it for longer. Or if someone started a journal back in February or March documenting those earlier days before we were all kind of told to go home, then we would love to have those kinds of entries too. If you go to our website, which is wisconsinhistory.org, there's a way that you can register for the journal project. And when you register for the journal project, we're asking people to kind of make a commitment to either 30, 60, or 90 days of journaling. And if that changes or we have to make adjustments, that's totally fine.
So what would you say to encourage people from all walks of life and jobs and current situations to participate? Perhaps someone thinks, I'm just trying to survive day to day. You know, what do I have to contribute to the bigger picture of what's happening?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that historians and archivists are always looking for is information on the experiences of everyday people. And sometimes those are harder to find than what we would like. You know, we often think of politicians and people that are involved, well-known figures, that their letters and papers and things are the things that get saved. But really, historians now are really interested in what was the experience of day-to-day life and how that was affected. The other thing I would say about this specific pandemic and kind of crisis that we're living through is that the sort of people who aren't traditionally in the limelight are suddenly getting more attention and sort of being, you know, cast into the limelight, sort of jobs and things that we don't often think of and maybe we take for granted on a day-to-day basis are becoming just vital to survival and existence. And so there's something really valuable in having the experiences from a wide spectrum of people so that we can sort of document that for future generations to understand.
There's also a lot of kids home from school, and perhaps journaling and writing might help not only take up some time and be an activity, but maybe help them process things a little bit. Are you looking for voices of all ages?
Yeah, definitely. We've begun conversations with some school teachers. There are a few teachers in the area that are doing it as a school project. So their entire class will be keeping journals for the duration of the time that they're home. And even parents that are, you know, struggling with homeschooling. I am a parent of four, and I am definitely always looking for things to come up with for my kids to do while we're home. And, you know, having them have like a quiet reflective time where they have to, you know, write for 5 or 10 minutes, or even just keep like a Word doc or something like that, where they're just writing online for 10 minutes might be a useful thing to help them process. Yeah.
So say I'm sitting down and trying to start a journal, but don't know where to begin. Do you have any helpful tips for journaling during this pandemic? especially if people don't practice writing a lot?
Well, there are some writing prompts that are listed on the website. So if you end up going to the website to register for the project, there are some writing prompts there. We're really asking people to just sort of think about their everyday life and what they did each day, how they passed the time, what they encountered, how they felt about certain news articles and things that they saw online or just, you know, heard about. But there's also like a wide variety of writing clubs and writing groups out there. So if you have access to the internet and you just, Google search like a writing club, there's endless amounts of groups out there that can help you get started with writing prompts.
So what's your hope, not just in collecting stories, but for the people who will contribute to this journaling project?
Yeah, so we're sort of hoping that the journaling project will do a couple things. Like we said, that we really want to collect the stories of a wide variety of people, that we're not just hearing the same voices over and over again. So we're really hoping that, you know, all ages and professions and backgrounds will be submitting journals so that we have really a wide variety of voices in the collection. And then the other thing is that we're hoping that it does serve as like a reflective tool, that people can see this as an opportunity to sort of think about how they're doing and use the time that they're spending to write or photograph or create some sort of artistic expression in a journal to sort of help them deal with the situation that we're living in. One of the pieces that we've noticed as we've worked through the project, as our staff has worked through the project, and as we've sort of been developing materials, is that there are a lot of corollaries to these big events that have happened in the past. So whether it's the Civil War soldiers who were keeping journals or the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic that came through, that we're seeing that a lot of the things that happened in those moments of crisis are happening again today. And so kind of the patterns that we see in history and the human experience are really coming through.
Definitely. Well, Simone Munson, thank you so much for your time today and for initiating and helping out with this journaling project. I hope a lot of people add their voices.
Yeah, me too. Thanks so much.
Simone Munson is the Wisconsin Historical Society Librarian Archives Collection Development Coordinator. We spoke in May about the COVID-19 journaling project, and you can still sign up if you're interested. There's more information how at wuwm.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.